The views expressed on the following broadcasts do not necessarily reflect those of KHLT, Take 12 Radio, or our affiliates. The opinions on this show should not be considered as medical, psychological, or professional advice and are those of the host, co-host, and guest. Take 12 Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting are not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
One day at a time with its failures and fears. Portion of pain and burden of care, we must meet.
Welcome to Walking Through the Language of the Heart, a journey into the grapevine writings of Alcoholics Anonymous co-founder Bill W. And now, here are your co-hosts, Chris S. and the Monty Man.
Well, zippity-doo-dah, zippity-day, welcome once again to another fine broadcast of Walking Through the Language of the Heart with our co-host, Chris S., and we are going through the book, The Language of the Heart. These are Bill W.'s articles that he's written for the Grapevine from 1944 to 1970. And our good friend Chris S., I've worked with Chris before. Many of you know that from Walking Through the Big Book and Walking Through the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, and now this series, this workshop. And as always, Chris, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on and being such a big part of Take 12 Recovery Radio, my friend.
Thank you, Monty. You know, I love everything that you do, and it's really a lot of fun to be back together after, must be 10 years now since we did the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I'm really looking forward. This is a really cool workshop. You know, for anybody that hasn't been here before, The Language of the Heart is a book of Bill Wilson's grapevine writings. So Bill had an in with the editor of the Grapevine magazine. So he wasn't likely to get a rejection letter if he sent something in. But what really is amazing about this, what I'm finding amazing, is we're witnessing through his writings in these articles, we're witnessing the birth and growth of Alcoholics Anonymous as an institution, you know, and you can see so much of his guiding hand and how the fellowship seemed to adopt and follow a lot of the wisdom that he's coming up with in these articles. So it's been a lot of fun for me, Monty.
Me as well. And it is always interesting to crack open a book that either we haven't read in years and years or certainly don't remember most of this stuff. It's eye-opening for me. There have been several people that have written in and several people in my home group that have mentioned how much they're enjoying this series as well. So this week, this article is entitled Last 7 Years Have Made AA Self-Supporting.
Yeah, so, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess, was, they considered it 7 years old at that time.
Yeah.
You know, that's a long time ago, 1947. Anyway, let's get started on it. You know, he's been talking a lot about money in some of these articles, and he's really kind of deciding what's okay and what's not okay. He's talking a lot about clubhouses. He's talking a lot about the stuff that was really important in the early days. You know, in normal 12-step groups today, you don't worry too much about the money. It's just,
right.
It's, you know, there's a treasurer and, you know, there's suggested ways to use that money. And it just kind of happens. And very few people really even, you know, pay attention to it. But I think in the early days, it was a concern. Yeah, there were people who were worrying a lot about, you know, was this going to be a money-making scheme for some people? And I think a lot of these articles are one of the purposes of them is to show people that this whole thing is for fun and for free, but we need some money. We need some money for literature. We need some money, you know, for rent. So let's figure out the least complicated way, you know, to put this together so we can have a central office and everything. And let's not accumulate wealth, because the second you have more money than you need, there's going to be all kinds of people complaining about it. So I think that's kind of the atmosphere that was going on back then. I'll get started here. So
okay.
This is last 7 years have made AA self-supporting, August 1947. How we ever got the book and our office through that summer of 1939, I shall never know. Had it not been for a truly sacrificial act on the part of Bert T, an early New York AA, I'm sure we couldn't have survived. Bert loaned the defunct Works Publishing Company $1,000, obtained by signing a note secured by his own business. This act of faith was followed by two more pieces of good fortune, which barely got us through the year. In the fall of 1939, Liberty Magazine published a piece about us. This produced a flood of inquiries and some orders for the AA book. Those few book receipts kept our little central office going. Then came a burst of articles in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. This started a prodigious growth of AA out there and created a little more demand for the AA book. You know, the story of the book was, you know, when they published it, they sent out all these little postcards to every doctor, in America. And then they waited a couple of days, you know, in anticipation. And then they went down to the post office, literally with sacks, because they were going to need to carry all the responses, all the orders for the book back. There's going to be so many of them, they're going to need sacks, right? And they show up, and there's like a handful of orders for the book, and most of them are so illegible that, you know, they're written by people that were so drunk that they couldn't even figure out who the person was or what the address was. It was a real disappointment. Wow. So they were stuck with this massive amount of first edition books that I bet you and I wish we had access to, you know.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, I would have paid $3 or whatever it was for those.
Yeah,
they're worth a fortune now, those first editions. Anyway, it says, nor were our friends at Rockefeller Center idle. One day in February 1940, Dick Richardson reported that Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr. had been following our progress with intense interest, that he would like, for the inspiration of his guests and for the benefit of Alcoholics Anonymous, to give a dinner. We regarded this as a 10 strike. In March 1940, the dinner came off. Mr. R.'s friends turned out in force. An AA member was placed at each guest table. Dr. Harry S. Emerson Fosdick, who had superbly reviewed our book, spoke of AA from the spiritual viewpoint. Dr. Foster Kennedy, a noted neurologist, gave his hearers the medical outlook. We alcoholics were asked to talk also. At the conclusion of the evening, Mr. Nelson Rockefeller explained that his father had not been able to come because of illness, went on to say that a few things more deeply affecting or promising than Alcoholics Anonymous had ever touched his father's life, that he wished his friends to share this experience with him. Though great wealth was present at the dinner meeting that night, little was said about money. Hope was expressed that AA might soon become self-supporting, but the suggestion was made that until AA became self-supporting, a little financial help might be needed. Following the dinner meeting, Mr. Rockefeller wrote a personal letter to each guest expressing his feeling about AA and concluding with the observation that he was making us a modest gift. Accompanying each letter was a reprint of the talk given at the dinner and a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. On receipt of Mr. Rockefeller's letter, many of his guests responded with donations to the Alcoholic Foundation. The so-called Rockefeller dinner list has since been almost the only source of outside money and gifts to the Alcoholic Foundation. These donations averaged around $3,000 annually, and they were continued for about 5 years, from 1940 to about 1945. This income, the foundation divided between Dr. Bob and me to enable us to give AA a good part of our time during that critical period. Not long since, the foundation trustees were able to write the original donor contributors with great thanks that their help would no longer be needed, that the Alcoholic Foundation had become adequately supported by the AA groups and by income from the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that the personal needs of Dr. Bob and myself were being met out of book royalties. You know, that's really interesting. So for a 5 year period of time, the Rockefeller list, you know, was really keeping basically Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob from having, you know, to not have a place to live. You know, Dr. Bob would have lost his house. You know, Bill Wilson wouldn't have been able to keep up the office and done the early foundational work that the fellowship needed. So that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. And by 1945 or so, the book Alcoholics Anonymous was selling well enough that at least a stipend was available for the both of them, due to that money coming in. The significant thing about Mr. Rockefeller's dinner, of course, was not only the money it raised. What we did need then, even as much, was favorable public recognition. We needed someone who would stand up and say what he thought and felt about Alcoholics Anonymous. Considering the fact that we were then few in number, that we were none too sure of ourselves, that not long since society had known us as common drunkards, I think Mr. Rockefeller's wisdom and courage were great indeed. And I would have to agree with that. The effect of that dinner meeting was instantaneous. The news press wires all carried the story. Hundreds of alcoholics and their families rushed to buy the book. Our little central office was flooded with pleas for help. It soon had to be moved from New Jersey to Vesey Street, New York. Ruth Hawk got her back pay and forthwith became our first national secretary. Enough books were sold to keep the office going. So past 1940, Alcoholics Anonymous had made its national debut. You know, so imagine from like 1935 to 1940, really wondering if this thing is really going to make it. Mm-hmm. You know, you're seeing, Monty, you're seeing people get sober. You understand that the step process, as it was understood back then, led to recoveries. And, you know, the learning about how to work with alcoholics and you know, Dr. Bob was heavy into that. And he never stopped. I mean, he was a mass producing recovery generator. You know, he would just constantly be working with people. Mm-hmm. Bill, you know, worked with people, but his main focus was on, you know, preserving this society. And I think it was a perfect blend of two personalities in those early days that supported and were really, really good at producing what we have today. You know, that's my thought.
So I have a question. Is there any record that you know of any major disagreements or discords between Bill and Bob, that, you know, any blow-ups, anything that they, you know, came fisticuffs with? I mean, you know, when you hang out with a buddy for that long, there's got to be some interesting tales, don't you think?
You know, listening to Bill speak, you know, on some of the old tapes, after Dr. Bob's death, he basically stated that they never had a cross word with each other.
Wow.
Now, that wasn't the case with Bill and some of the other people in Akron and Cleveland.
No.
You know, there was some animosity going on between Ohio and New York. But Dr. Bob didn't play a role in that as far as I know. Now, that doesn't mean Dr. Bob agreed with everything Bill did. I'm not convinced Dr. Bob thought the book Alcoholics Anonymous was a good idea. He didn't participate very much at all in its writing, you know, but he didn't tell Bill not to do it. He didn't tell him it was a stupid idea. And as it became clear that this book really was being written, you know, he was supportive of it. But some of the things like the traditions and things like that, Dr. Bob was not in agreement. Certainly a lot of the people in Ohio were not in agreement with some of the direction Bill was taking. He took it anyway. You know, and I'm glad he did.
Yeah.
So it says here, just a year later, the Saturday Evening Post assigned Jack Alexander to do a story about us. Under the impetus of Mr. Rockefeller's dinner and the Cleveland Plain Dealer pieces, our membership had shot up to about 2,000. Our Clevelanders had just proved that even a small group could, if it must, successfully absorb great numbers of newcomers in a hurry. And that was Clarence. That was Clarence Snyder. He was a driving force of the Cleveland group, and they got about the business of helping people recover. And you know, the cool thing is Clarence Snyder lived, I think, until the 80s, and you can get a lot of his talks. He was one of the last of the first 100. You can get a lot of his talks and a lot of his workshops online, because by the time people were really paying attention to the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, Clarence Snyder was still around, and you'd interview him. You'd have to do it in his house with a squeaking parrot behind him, you know, but these tapes exist, you know what I mean? And for history buffs, they're wonderful. He tells the old stories of the first groups,
right?
You know, there's nobody left around now. There's nobody left around that's alive now who can do that. Unfortunately. Anyway, they had exploded the myth that AA must always grow slowly. From the Akron, Cleveland area, we had begun to spread into other places, Chicago, Detroit, and the Midwest. In the East, Philadelphia had taken fire. Washington and Baltimore were smoldering. Further west, Houston, Los Angeles, and San Francisco were taking spark. Growth continued at Akron and New York. We took special pride in Little Rock, Arkansas, which had sprung up with no personal contact with AA, having caught on through books and letters from the central office. Little Rock was the first of the so-called mail-order groups, now commonplace all over the world. Even then, we started correspondence with many isolated alcoholics who were to form groups later on. That's interesting. Little Rock, Arkansas. Mm. You know, that's where the late, great Joe and Charlie hail from, right? So they were the first, they really thought the book Alcoholics Anonymous was going to get sent all over the place and people were going to start groups and start taking, you know, it didn't necessarily happen that way.
Yeah.
At least the majority of the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous was one person carrying the message into an area who had experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. So it says, despite this progress, the approaching Saturday Evening Post piece worried us. While our Cleveland experience had given assurances that our few established groups would survive the impact of heavy publicity, what could we possibly do with the thousands of burning appeals that would now swamp our little New York office, then staffed by Ruth Hawk, a typist, and myself? How could three people handle the thousands of frantic inquiries we expected? The Post article would bring more book sales, but not enough to handle this emergency. We needed more office help, and quickly, or we must be prepared to throw heartbreaking appeals into the wastebasket. We realized we must, for the first time, ask AA groups for assistance. The Alcoholic Foundation still had no money, save the $3,000 a year dinner fund, which was helping to keep Dr. Bob and me afloat. Besides, some of the creditors and cash subscribers of Works Publishing, the AA book company, were getting anxious again. So what Bill did, I don't know if he's going to say this, but what Bill did was he took 33% of the stock. Dr. Bob got it. He took 33% of the stock, and then he sold fraudulent stock certificates for the other third of the profits of the books. And a lot of people who bought this stock had to wait. You know, they weren't getting any money. And I forget exactly what the stocks were, like $50 a share, $10 a share. So I forget. But, you know, they'd put that money out 5 years ago and nothing's coming in, I guess, is what he's saying.
Wow.
So two of the alcoholic members of our foundation traveled out among the AA groups to explain the need. They presented their listeners with these ideas: that support of our central office was a definite responsibility of the AA groups, that answering written inquiries was a necessary assistance to our 12-step work, that we AAs ought to pay these office expenses ourselves and rely no further upon outside charity or insufficient book sales. The two trustees also suggested that the Alcoholic Foundation be made a regular depository for group funds, that the Alcoholic Foundation would earmark all group monies for central office expenses only, that each month the central office would bill the foundation for the straight AA expenses of the place, that all group contributions ought to be entirely voluntary, that every AA group would receive equal service from the New York office, whether it contributed or not. It was estimated that if each group sent the foundation a small sum equal to $1 per member per year, this might eventually carry our office without other assistance. Under this arrangement, the office would ask the groups twice yearly for funds and render, at the same time, a statement of expenses for the previous period. Our two trustees, Horace C. and Bert T., did not come back empty-handed. Now, clearly understanding the situation, most groups began contributing to the Alcoholic Foundation for central office expenses and have continued to do so ever since. In this practice, the AA tradition of self-supporting had a firm beginning. Thus, we handled the Saturday Evening Post article for which thousands of AAs are today so grateful. Now, how about that, Monty? Say there's 2,000 members at that time, and they're asking each member for $1 a year. Do you know what the prudent reserve for Alcoholics Anonymous is now, you know, in Riverside Avenue? It's like $18 million a year.
Wow.
So that's the amount of money that they want to have on hand for like three quarters of a year expenses or something like that. You know, inflation is real, Monty. and also they hired every kind of person you can hire. So it's definitely grown and it's definitely changed. I wonder if Bill would be okay.
Yeah. So is it common where you are? I'm just trying to think if this is pretty much across the board when it comes to the seventh tradition, and it comes to the period of time in the year when you're sending your GSR to the area meeting or the district meeting or whatever, and then they're giving funds. Is it, because I can't remember, is it more common to pay first the expenses of whatever the rental is on the meeting hall, then the prudent reserve, and then the rest of the money goes? Or is it,
each group has a treasurer.
Yeah.
And the treasurers are it's assumed that they're going to be responsible.
Right.
And so there's suggested ways each group is going to suggest that the money be handled. Probably the most common way is you got to take care of your rent first, or you got no meeting.
Right.
You got to have the coffee and the literature, or you know you're going to really look lame. So let's say that stuff happens first.
Yeah.
You know. Then a lot of groups, you know, send some money to intergroup. They send some money to their area. You know, like I'm in area 44. So the area gets some contributions, and the central office in New York is a part of that donation. And so that's kind of normal, but listen, each group is autonomous. Each group can mm-hmm. handle their business the way they want to. You have more of a right to be wrong than yeah. you do for Alcoholics Anonymous to chase after you and tell you, you know, you're not doing it right. So, but you know, there's pamphlets, there's, you know, I don't know if most people know this, but like if you're starting a group, you know, they will send you this binder, you know, that's got all kinds of information on home group and, you know, all kinds of recommendations and stuff like that. But, you know, I believe that, you know, at this period of time, there was the central office. Now we have areas that need money, and the areas have districts
right.
that need money.
Yeah.
So Alcoholics Anonymous has grown at that rate. An inner group, you know, has raised its head up and said, hey, you know, we need some money. So it's more complicated than just, you know, sending a dollar a year to the central office today.
I don't know what it's like where your meeting halls are and so forth, but I know that the ones that I've visited don't seem to have much upgrades going on. You know what I mean? It's like the tables are still filled with holes.
Yeah.
The chairs are still pretty raggedy. You know, if anything does happen, it's usually by, you know, the big hearted people that just volunteer their time to maybe put a new coat of paint on the inside of the room or something like that. But for the most part, even the clubs, they're pretty run down. They're functional to the degree that they can be functional. And that's pretty much it. Is that common where you're at?
A lot of times. Now, you have to understand, I'm in the Northeast. I'm in the tri-state metro, almost close to the metropolitan area. So most of the times we meet in churches, and sometimes we meet in really nice churches, and sometimes the churches give us a really nice room.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're in the basement with the hissing radiators, you know, and no one has stripped the floor in 47 years. You know, it's all different. People that experience the clubhouses, the clubhouses that I've gone to are rustic. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They are old homes that no one wants to live in anymore. And, you know, somebody donated the $30,000 property or whatever, you know, to the committee or the board of directors who's going to run, you know, the clubhouse. And, you know, Bill Wilson says in the traditions, in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, you'll remember this. He said, when alcoholics get sober and they become tighter than the bark on a tree.
Yeah.
hey, everybody in here who wants to contribute $50, you know, to to paint the place up, put new lights, put in new carpet, raise your hand. You're not going to get a hand raised. You know, you're just not, you know what I mean?
I know.
So that's my experience. You know,
yeah.
I think the value is in our helping other people.
Yeah.
You know, our value is not in, you know, keeping places up. I don't think.
Right.
But that's just me. All right. It says here, the enormous inpouring of fresh members quickly laid the foundation for hundreds of new AA groups. And they soon began to consult the central office about growing pains, thus confronting our service headquarters with group problems as well as personal inquiries. The office then began to publish a list of all AA groups, and it furnished traveling AAs with lists of prospects in cities which had none. Out-of-towners we had never seen before began to visit us. So started what is today the huge network of personal contact between our central office staff at New York and the AA groups throughout the world. And again, in America, you know, certainly people go in and visit, you know, Riverside Avenue. You can go in there. There's a meeting there. I mean, you can go in and you can experience a meeting at General Service Headquarters, right? But so many of the inquiries and so many of the 12-step calls and so many of the hotlines and everything that Alcoholics Anonymous does comes out of the area and you know, comes out of the area and the district offices today. it's not a direct hotline to New York anymore. You know, it's intergroup will have night watch. I don't know if you have night watch in your area, Monty, but that's where someone will be on, will take a shift, an 8-hour shift or a 12-hour shift, and be available to talk to drunks, calling up the helpline, asking for help. You'll get an alcoholic on the other end of the phone 24/7. So that's kind of how it's handled in our area. Is it similar in your area?
Yeah, it has. It's been years since I volunteered for hotline service. In fact, I'll tell you how long it's been. We had beepers.
Wow.
You'd sign up. Yeah. You'd go to a district meeting or something, and you'd sign up, right? And they would hand out the beepers, and then you'd have to find a way to pass that beeper on to the next shift, that kind of thing. But yeah, there's always availability 24 hours a day.
So I've been sober long enough to remember having a beeper at work, getting beeped, and then trying to find the nearest payphone. You know, that was like 10 times a day. Right. Sometimes I'd have to do that.
Yep.
You know, some of the millennials and stuff, the people today, Gen X, you know, they've grown up, you know, with a cell phone in their hand from like 4 years old.
Yeah.
That ain't the way it was back in the day.
Nope.
You know, when I got sober, they didn't have cars, Monty. You had to take a train to the meeting, you know. I mean, you know, it goes way back. Anyway.
Funny.
I jest. So it says here, the year 1941 was a great one for the growing AA. It was the beginning of the huge development to follow. Our central office got solid group backing. We began to abandon the idea of outside charitable help in favor of self-support. Last but not least, our alcoholic foundation really commenced to function. By this time, linked to the AA Central Office because of its responsibility for the group funds being spent there and to Works Publishing, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, by partial ownership, the trustees of our Alcoholic Foundation had already become, though they did not realize it, the custodians for Alcoholics Anonymous, both of money and of tradition. Alcoholics Anonymous had become a national institution. And this is by 1941. And you know what? We've talked about this in other shows. I've got a lot of old movies. And in the old movies, they would show Alcoholics Anonymous members, you know, doing 12-step calls on people. There's another one, Days of Wine and Roses,
yes.
Come Back Little Sheba. I mean, there's a ton of them, and you get to see the guys in the hats and the coats and the ties come and, you know, call on the drunk. And they were about that business back then.
Yep.
12-step calls was the majority of their participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. The meetings were secondary and certainly not as time consuming as the 12-step calls that all these people were going on. You know, you read the chapter Working with Others in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it paints a beautiful picture of what these people were doing. You know, how you worked with other alcoholics. You went and you found them, Monty. You didn't wait for them to raise their hand and say they're new. You went and you found them.
Yeah.
And that's what was going on. That's what was going on back then.
So we went out searching to help bring a solution to them. We weren't doing like we do today, where, you know, we're depending on them to show up and walk through the door. In fact, I've heard it said, if you're not willing to walk through the door, I'm not willing to work with you. Well, that's kind of contrary to where it was before. Some people are unable to walk through the door, but they have their heart is to walk through the door. They're just not able to do it. And if we can't meet them where they are, I mean, I don't know about you, Chris. God met me where I was. You know, he didn't expect me to come crawling to him. He met me where I was, you know, through the hand of fellowships like AA. And I didn't go search it out. I really didn't. It was because of somebody coming to me. So, yeah.
So Monty, just a little of my personal experience with this. You know, you and I agree on 99.9999% of the, you know, no, we agree on 100% of the stuff together. But in the last 2 weeks, you know, I've been instrumental in helping three different people, you know, find some type of an entrance into a path toward wellness. You know, that could include detox, treatment, AA, or all the above, right? You know, let's get you headed in the right direction.
Yeah.
Now, here's what I believe. I believe that there are tons of people out there who desperately want help, who are not coming to AA. They're not coming to NA. They're not coming to CAA because they don't know anything. They don't know about it. You know, they've heard maybe some stuff.
Yep.
They don't know that they don't think it's for them. They don't understand. So there is an abject need for people to be available to be that first point of contact, not the person that looks up AA in the phone book and makes the call, the person who's still sick and suffering, who doesn't know what to do, doesn't even know to call AA, right? We need to be available for them. And kind of how I do it is, listen, you know, I'm at a point now where I've got maybe 3 years of work left, and I took a job, and everybody at the job knows I'm in recovery, and I don't care. You know, I don't blab my 12-step membership, but I tell everybody I'm in recovery, and I help other people who want to get in recovery. And in the last month, two people at work asked me to help their kids. You know, and so this is kind of what we're doing. And it can be as easy as a suggestion. It can be as hard as a navigation into treatment with talking with parents and meeting at the diner and all the stuff that's involved with that. But this is our job. And yeah. I'm telling you, there's something going on in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I think the selfish and self-centered, lazy aspects of some people in Alcoholics Anonymous allow them to believe that all they need to do is twice a week go to their little loony, you know, walk in 5 minutes before the meeting, you know, walk out right after, and that's it. That's all they need to do. And that is so far from the expectations that you find in our literature that it's not funny, you know. I am not the police. I don't single people out and criticize them. I've been a real fan of the work that they've put together in the book Alcoholics Anonymous and the path that it's laid out and the suggestions that it makes, that I'm the type of guy who wants to hold on to that stuff, because what I've seen, the evidence that has been presented to me over the last 33 years is the people who do that pay attention to what the book is saying, do what the book is saying. I see them day after week after month after year after decade, right where they are, you know, maintaining sobriety absolutely, but enjoying all of the gifts and all of the promises of recovery. And I see, you know, I see the people that blow through meetings, you know, like they're a bar. I don't see that in the, you know, in the meeting population, where people don't get involved in anything except the meeting, you know, and, you know, that's just kind of what I've seen.
I think
I have a feeling you've got the same kind of
experience.
Yeah,
it's disturbing, at best. One of the reasons that I have such a passion for doing workshops like this with you and walking through the big book, the 12 and 12, and some of the other things that we've done here at Take 12 Radio is because there's such a lack. But let me put it this way. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and I was listening to a lady who I think the world of her. We don't agree on a lot of issues, but she's a friend. We don't have to agree on everything. But somebody quoted something out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she challenged them. They thought she was reading out of the Bible, and they weren't. They were reading out of the big book. This person had been going to meetings for decades and didn't know her own literature. And I've never forgotten that. And I'm thinking, wow, that's like missing the main course. I mean, that's just, meetings is like the dessert, but there's no nourishment there. You know what I mean? You got to get into the filet mignon of this thing, which is the written word in it, to really get all that you can out of it. I don't know. I guess some people don't want all they can get. I'm selfish, man. I want to get as much as I can. Once I sunk my teeth into some of this stuff, I wanted more.
You know, listen, looking around the general population, right? Many, many people who show up in the 12-step rooms want to do the least amount they need to do to stay separated, to stay sober, and to stay separated. Mm-hmm. And when you do the least amount, you get a least amount. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the amount you're going to get is that least. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is it's 1,000 miles deep. Like all you have to do is start to apply, a fraction of these principles in this book, and you're going to start to see results. Now, there are a lot of people that I've loved in the rooms who are that type of person. They see it as an overreaction to like go make amends or to sponsor or to pray or meditate. You know, I've never done that. I don't need to do that. You know, I've been sober for 6 years. All right. So you're gonna marginally do this recovery work because you're staying sober. But what you're missing is you're missing the spiritual awakening, which is the whole point.
Yeah.
You know, having had an awakened spirit as the result of these steps, we're organically driven out to help other people. And through all of that, our quality of life is as good as it can get. Lonnie, I've known you for years. You're one of the happiest, most content, most serene, most spiritually sound people I've known. But I guarantee it's directly proportional to all the work that you're doing trying to carry the message.
Amen.
You know what I mean? It's not, you weren't genetically the way you are now. As a matter of fact, genetically, you had some twisted genes. You know, if you go look back into your history, right?
Yeah.
So directly proportional to this work is not only our sobriety but our recovery, and not only our recovery but our quality of life. You know, I really believe that, and so many people miss that. You know, they miss it, and I for one will always be carrying a message of depth and weight. And how I define a message of depth and weight is that I've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the 12 steps, and my life is awesome.
Yeah.
That's a message of depth and weight, yeah. Whether you like it or not. You know what I mean? That's whether you like it or not. So it says here, quietly but effectively, the evolution of our foundation has since continued. Several years ago, the trustees had a certified audit made of the Alcoholic Foundation and Works Publishing, from their very beginnings. A good bookkeeping system was installed and regular audits became an established custom. What he's not saying here, because Bill Wilson just refuses to criticize anybody in print or talk about any of the dark experiences really, you know, in a way that could be damaging to any people, was there were people in Ohio who were accusing him of absconding with all these AA funds. This is a Bill Wilson get rich quick scheme, and so he brought in auditors. He brought in auditors that said, from the very beginning, I want you to cover every single dime that's gone in and out of here. And they did. And then he had to go and he had to present this audit, this audit to certain people in certain groups. And they still hated him. you know, so I love how he puts it. He puts it here. He makes it so positive.
Yeah.
When it was like probably a torturous experience for him. But anyway, about 1942, it became evident that the foundation ought to complete its ownership of Works Publishing by calling in the stock of outstanding cash subscribers of Works. Several thousand dollars were required to do this, and of course, group funds could not be used for this purpose. So he had to pay back the people who had bought stock. At least that's the decision that was made. Boy, it would be cool to own stock in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I think there were some business decisions that closed all that out, you know, to the general public. But let's see what he says here. So the trustees, spearheaded this time by our old friend Chip, turned again to Mr. Rockefeller and his dinner list. These original donors most gladly made the foundation the necessary loan, which enabled the foundation to acquire full ownership of our AA book, Works Publishing Incorporated. So he borrowed money from the Rockefellers to pay off all the fraudulent stock certificates. That's really interesting.
Wow.
Meanwhile, Works Publishing, now being partly relieved of supporting the central office, had been able to pay its own creditors in full. Later on, when out of AA book income, the trustees offered to pay off the foundation debt, several of the lenders would take only a part payment, some none at all. At last, we were in the clear. This event marked the end of our financial troubles. So what I had heard is we paid back the Rockefellers, right? What Bill is saying here is some of the Rockefellers gave some money, but it was the dinner list people that gave money. And when we went to pay them back, some of them said, no, you guys need it more than we do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. I did not know that. I certainly don't remember reading this 30 years ago. Anyway, the last few years of AA have been phenomenal. Nearly everybody in America knows about AA. Seemingly, the rest of the globe will soon learn as AA travelers go abroad and our literature is translated into other tongues. Today, our General Service Headquarters has a staff of 12. Because of our prodigious growth and the continuous entry of AA into more foreign countries, the headquarters will presently need 20. They had 12 people in 1947 working in the central office.
Oh.
That surprises me, but okay. Popularly known to thousands as Bobby, our AA General Secretary now serves World AA. On the board of the Alcoholic Foundation, three of the early trustees whose contributions to AA is incalculable remain. New faces are seen at the quarterly meetings, each as anxious to serve as the original group. The AA Grapevine, our national monthly periodical, which made its appearance 3 years ago, is now taking its place among our general headquarters services and is almost paying its own way already. Out of its Work Publishing income, the foundation has accumulated a prudent financial reserve for the future. That reserve now stands at more than a full year's headquarters expense, which still remains not much above the very low figure of $1 per AA member per year. 2 years ago, the trustees set aside out of the AA book funds a sum which enabled my wife and me to pay off the mortgage on our home and make some needed improvements. That must be stepping stones.
Yeah, I would think so.
That's interesting. The foundation also granted Dr. Bob and me each a royalty of 10% on the book Alcoholics Anonymous, our only income from AA sources. We are both very comfortable and deeply grateful. So 10%. Now, there's been a lot of talk. I've heard a lot of talk over the years. If this is accurate, if Bill's telling the truth here, people told me he was getting a whole lot more than that. But him and Dr. Bob getting 10% each on the book from, you know, the 40s. That's generous, for Bill, because he wrote it. And you know, it's admirable, I think.
I think so.
And certainly, you know, for writing the book, he should get some royalties. You know, it's the way of publishing. So this account of the stewardship of Alcoholics Anonymous during its infancy brings us to the present, the year 1947. With continued AA growth and AA service, the future's promise. That is really, really some interesting history, Monty. What do you think of that one?
I'm thinking every time we do one of these, I didn't bring this up before. I keep forgetting to, but I'm thinking if Bill were alive today, what would his articles look like today? I'm certain that he would have a lot to say. He certainly did back then. I think there are some people that just want to throw Bill Wilson under the bus no matter what. You know, they just have that I don't know why kind of thing. You know, he was a shyster and he was a liar and he was this and he was that. And I'm like, yeah, he was you. He was me, you know, he was us. And that's why I love him so much.
You know, he gets treated unfairly. There was a movie not too long ago. Many of us really, really criticized it. I'm not going to say its name, but in the movie, they had the son or the grandson of the person that Bill Wilson was supposedly having the affair with. You know, in the 50s and 60s, right?
Yeah.
And they gave him more time in that movie than they gave Tom Ivester. you know what I mean? Like Tom Ivester played second fiddle to like the grandson of the woman that Bill supposedly had an affair with. It was insane. But listen, sometimes people want to make things, outrageous because outrageous sells. From what I know about Bill Wilson, let's say he never said he was a saint. He never put himself up on a pedestal. He never said he was free of character defects,
No.
But the amount of good that guy did, far outweighs any small perceived, inequity or, impropriety that somebody might be able to dig up. You know what I mean? It's that doesn't tap my brakes, hearing about stuff like that. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, first of all, I was going to say, look at the patriarchs in the Bible, for crying out loud. These are adulterers and murderers and thieves and the lowest of the low, and we raise them to high esteem. I mean, but I think there's a reason for that because they're us. When I had William Borchert on the show a couple of times, when we talked about the book he wrote, I think it was called My Father a Drunk or something like that. And of course we had referred several times during that interview on the screenwriting of My Name is Bill W. The second show that we did with him, when we talked about the Lois Wilson story, When Love Is Not Enough, I had a guest with me in the studio, and I brought her in because of her fascination with the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought she would enjoy, being part of the interview with William Borchert. So one of the things she asked William, and I had no idea that she was going to ask this, she asked William about Bill's affair, quote unquote. I need to know about Bill's affair. And William, I could tell that he was turning beet red. I just knew it. He was hot because, you know, his wife and Lois were very, very close friends. And he was adamant. William Borchert was adamant that that was a crock and that he did a lot of things. But as far as he knew and with his connections with that family, Bill was not unfaithful. Now, whether he was or he wasn't or whatever, but I'll tell you what I found in this person that was sitting in the show with me, she really wanted that to be true. And I was just kind of, I was thrown back by it. And you could tell that William Borchert, this was not the first time that he was asked that question. And he kind of had it up to his neck with that question. So I haven't heard much about that particular issue in a long time, but back then it was a thing. Well, you know how you male alcoholics are. There's no way he didn't have an affair. So I don't know, but yeah, it made for an interesting show.
Yeah, you know, I'm not convinced Bill was unfaithful. No, I'm not convinced he was faithful either.
Right.
But I'm not convinced he was unfaithful. There's some real serious people that I've talked to who do not believe he was. You know, some of the people who were running Stepping Stones, you know, some of the people who've really dug in deep into the archives do not believe that he was. Right. And then there's other people who says there, you know, there's proof, and yet who cares?
You're right.
You know, who cares? You know what's what's important about Bill Wilson? He was the principal architect of the most impactful spiritual movement of the 20th century.
Mm.
That's what's important about Bill Wilson. Mm.
Yeah. There you go. Well, next week, the article is entitled Traditions Stressed in Memphis Talk. So now we're going to be talking about the traditions more, right?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the traditions till we don't want to talk about the traditions, I have a feeling. Because he's developing them, you know? He's working it out. But it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah. All right. Well, as always, listeners, I encourage you to write in. We've had several of you email us, or you can comment on our YouTube version or any of the podcasting platforms listed at take12radio.com. Now, if you're having an issue getting to our website, take12radio, take and the number 12radio.com, don't fret. Just type in the word 12. It'll take you to the same place. So T-A-K-E, the word 12radio.com if you have an issue. We had somebody tell me last week that they were having trouble. So not to worry. You can always go there as well. All right, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you, Monty.
All right, until our next broadcast, this is the Monty Man along with our co-host, Chris S., and we're wishing God's perfect serenity for you. For more recovery workshops with Chris S. and the Monty Man, visit our website at take12radio.com and click on the Recovery Workshops banner.
This has been a broadcast of Take 12 Recovery Radio and KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.
Kitty, 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 kitty. Meow, meow, meow.
Woof, woof.